From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court recently ruled in favor of corporations over their workers by holding that employers can force arbitration agreements when hiring. The ruling effectively bars workers from being able to use class action lawsuits for redress. Class action suits have long been a powerful tool for workers to join forces with one another and sue companies for wrongdoing. Donald Trump's Supreme Court appointee Neil Gorsuch joined his conservative allies in the 5-4 decision. That anti-worker ruling bodes ill for another high-profile labor issue that the court heard arguments for earlier this year. A conservative ruling in the case of Janus versus AFSCME could gut the power of public sector unions to wield political power. The case centers around the so-called right to work, a deceptive Republican term used to obscure union dues. But my guest points out that a ruling in favor of Janus could pave the way for a labor bill of rights. Sean Richman is former organizing director for the American Federation of Teachers and a contributor to In These Times magazine. Welcome to the program, Sean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, before we get to the Janus case, let's talk about the ruling that just took place. Just days ago, the Supreme Court ruled in this issue of arbitration agreements for employers and really undermining the rights of class action lawsuits or the right for people to use class action lawsuits. How tremendous an effect could this have on the sort of modest power that workers have in today's market?
It's probably the most devastating anti-worker decision that the Supreme Court has issued in a long while, and the most devastating anti-worker decision that the Supreme Court will issue this term. It's worse for workers than Janus could potentially be,
because really?
Janus only applies to a small fraction of the unionized workforce, whereas this applies to the vast majority of non-union workers. And really just knocks out one of the last remaining ways that non-union workers can fight to get their back wages when bosses don't pay them the right amount or steal their wages or when they discriminate. It's a terrible decision that will have incredibly adverse effects for workers. That'll be felt far more quickly, I think, than Janus, if Janus goes the way that we all fear.
So just to then dig into it a little bit, after this ruling, companies, when hiring, could put into their contracts with the workers that they hire that arbitration agreements or arbitration hearings would have to be the sort of last resort measure to resolve any disputes that workers might have with their employers, and that those workers could not enter into future class action lawsuits. And now these companies have the legal right to force this on workers. Is that accurate?
Right. So there's two things going on here. There's forced arbitration, and then there's the class action waiver. Forced arbitration has skyrocketed since around 1992. That's the year after the Supreme Court issued a decision that sort of the conservative majority dusted off this 1925 law that simply said, hey, when the parties agree to arbitration, the court should back off and let the parties do arbitration. In that case, I think in that case, that was more about sort of fine print contracts that consumers sign. When you get a 2-year deal with Verizon for your cell phone, or AT&T, as you should be doing because it's unionized, there's the pages and pages of gobbledygook. One of the clauses in that's very common for almost any user agreement that you sign as a consumer is one that you agree that if there's any dispute to the terms that you're submitting it to arbitration, that you can't sue. The Supreme Court said, though, that should be respected if that's negotiated between the parties, as if somehow you, as one individual consumer, entered those negotiations on an equal footing with the massive AT&T corporation and had the ability to scratch out certain sections and say, no, this is not good. I don't agree to this term. I don't agree to this term. So that was a ridiculous decision, but it got the employers off to the races to say, great, let's start working this into employment agreements with our non-union workforce. And so the numbers are staggering. that maybe something like less than 5% of workers were working under terms of binding arbitration for individual disputes back in 1992. As of today, it's 55%. So the employers took that and ran with it. The class action waiver is one that further restricts you, because the binding arbitration was really about you dealing with the company as an individual, whereas class action is, you know, if Walmart is pervasively not paying overtime to overtime eligible employees, or is pervasively not promoting women or people of color, then all of those workers could join together in a lawsuit, because they're all affected, and that wasn't bound by the individual arbitration agreements that they might have been forced to sign as a condition of employment. So the class waiver now is these agreements, which are going to become, you know, just standard, are also going to just always and everywhere include a class action waiver. Already in anticipation of this decision, one third of non-union employers are forcing their workers to sign such agreements. In 10 years, it'll be, you know, the lion's share of non-union employers. Mm-hmm.
And then with respect to public sector unions, we have this decision coming up, oral arguments in the case of Janus versus AFSCME, heard in February. The decision could be coming out in the next several weeks, I understand. And you write that if this ruling goes as is expected to go, if Gorsuch basically does what he did in this arbitration story, that we could, of course, unions could see this impact on their political power. But you write in these times that it could actually backfire on conservatives and lead to a labor's bill of rights. What do you mean?
So first of all, Gorsuch is not the swing vote. Gorsuch is just a monster. If anybody is the swing vote, it's Chief Justice Roberts, who has to has to be concerned a little bit with his legacy in history, and could be potentially swayed by arguments that it's not just me making these arguments. It's a lot of people saying you could tear apart the entire labor relations framework, and employers aren't going to like that, because it could give unions new tools to fight back. So if the Supreme Court does the sort of the maximal anti-union attack that they can in this decision, what they have to do is they have to rule that every interaction that a union has with the government is inherently political, and therefore agency fees, which are compelling union-represented workers to pay for the services that they're benefiting from, is compelled political activity by the government for workers. And therefore unconstitutional, violates those workers' First Amendment rights, because they should be able to, that being a part of this political activity should be voluntary. It's a cockamamie argument. And if they make it, there's all kinds of arguments that our side should be making about interactions that the government has with unions that severely restrict unions' rights. As one example, right now, If private sector workers want to form a union and they file a petition at the National Labor Relations Board, and they're going to have an election to determine if there's going to be a union there, think of it this way. That is an election being conducted by an arm of the government, the results of which are determining whether those employees, those citizens, are going to have additional statutory rights respected and enforced. The conduct of the election, the rules of the election, as determined by the government through the NLRB, through Congress, and through the courts, the rules of the election are that one party and one party only can force all of the voters to attend mandatory presentations of their position on pain of termination.
And that's the employer.
Crucially, it's not just the employer. Because if the employer does a mandatory meeting to say, hey, unions are great, you should join, that's also illegal. Only the party that advocates a no vote can force people to attend one of these meetings and listen to their political views and browbeat them and threaten them and lie to them about a government-conducted election that's coming up. When you step back from it and you view it in that way, even without Janus, but certainly post-Janus, how is that not a massive violation of people's free speech rights?
So is this an argument that conservatives are fearing? And if so, could this then temper the decision coming out of the Supreme Court?
There were two very interesting amicus briefs that were filed in the case. An amicus brief is somebody's not a party to the case at all, but they're interested, and so they're hoping to get their stuff in the mix of what the judges are deciding. I don't know how much weight amicus briefs normally carry, but the interesting thing about this case, because the right wing was so obsessed with getting it to the Supreme Court as quickly as possible, the Janus side, the anti-union side, has never issued anything on the record in any of the lower courts. They've always said, we know you're going to rule against us. Rule against us. We want to get to the Supreme Court. So there's no record. There's no arguments outside of the arguments that took place in February at the Supreme Court and the briefs that have been filed, including the amici briefs. So they could carry some weight. One brief was, I'm going to mix up the two briefs. One was by Reagan's Solicitor General. Another one was by two libertarian professors, legal scholars. And both of them are warning about these sort of unintended consequences that this could open up. There was a decision that the Supreme Court had issued a number of years ago about free speech rights for public sector employees. And public sector employees actually enjoy free speech rights at work that private sector employees don't, because their employer is the government. But this Supreme Court case, this previous one, had held that really it's only when they're engaging in actually political activity that you can't be fired because you put a lawn sign for a certain candidate on your lawn and your supervisor is from the other party or supporting the other candidate. They can't hold it against you, or they can't hold against you that you supported a ballot initiative. In your role as a private citizen, they can't harm you at work for that. What the court had decided previously is that public sector employees don't have the right to object to routine duties. Basically, you can't be like Kim Davis and say, I'm not going to issue a marriage certificate because I don't agree with it. That's actually actionable and fireable. That's not protected political activity. You can carry a petition to get a ballot initiative on to say, we shouldn't have to let gay people be married, but in your role, in your official duties, you cannot refuse to do something that your employer is telling you to do. And so the Solicitor General, I believe, in his amicus, warned that Janus, if they rule that way, could just upend that entire decision.
So let's follow that. If the court does, despite these amicus briefs, rule in favor of Janus, and what would you like to see the labor movement do to exploit that decision?
Well, I think that we should be raising more free speech challenges to all kinds of rules that hold us back. Rules that prevent us from engaging in solidarity activities, of encouraging boycotts of a company that is closely related to the main employer that we're protesting, to the restrictions on our right to strike, which is a higher hurdle, because strike is not just speech, it's speech plus action. But there's a roadmap there. So we should be routinely challenging these sorts of things. One example, Act 10 in Wisconsin, Scott Walker's anti-union law, which tells unions that they are not allowed to in bargaining, they're not allowed to ask for anything other than a wage increase, and only a wage increase that doesn't exceed the cost of living. So if a teacher's union that has bargaining rights in Wisconsin wants to bargain for a lower class size, Scott Walker's law says you are not allowed to ask for that. And that's their speech. They should be allowed to ask for it, whether the employer agrees to it or not. So I think Act 10 is immediately challengeable. And I hope that all of the unions in Wisconsin immediately start filing lawsuits based on Janus, if it goes against us, to knock Act 10 out as unconstitutional under federal law and under the Janus holding. If, again, there's a chance that John Roberts actually cares about his reputation and about the chaos that people like me are threatening. Small chance, really small chance.
I mean, in this conversation, I'm getting the sense that, you know, we might be finally reaching the limits of how far within our constitutional framework one can push workers and push the labor movement and organized labor, because it's been pushed pretty hard already. And at some point, there's got to be some legal pushback or some basis for legal pushback. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Sean. We'll post a link to your work in These Times magazine. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Sean Richmond, former organizing director for the American Federation of Teachers and a contributor to In These Times. We've been discussing the Supreme Court and labor-related rulings. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.